Well, let me just start. That's a picture of a galaxy back there that we'll come back to in a second. So here's my summary. This talk is like mainly polemical, so I'm basically going to make an argument about what you should be doing in preparation for the dark energy smackdown. Because I have a third position, which I'm going to express, that's in between the two that come up. And then I'm going to show you an observation that we've done that just kind of shows you that what I'm talking about is possible. And I'm really asking the question, can we rule out CDM? And I'm not going to answer that question. And here's my outline. I'm going to spend a lot of time on a polemic, show you some data, and I'm not going to give you anything satisfying at the end. And I apologize for that. But it's because I'm talking about a really, really ambitious project, and the ambitious projects take a long time. But it's a kind of ambitious project that people here probably should be thinking about, because a lot of smart people and a lot of the challenges are theoretical. So I keep making a statement in talks, and nobody has ever smacked me down. I think CDM is the most well-tested physical theory, bar none. So people like to point to quantum electrodynamics because there's particular measurements. But the particular measurements in quantum electrodynamics are very trivial measurements of very individual numbers. CDM is incredibly diverse, the phenomena that are explained by CDM. And very importantly, unlike quantum electrodynamics, at least unlike the last few decimal places of quantum electrodynamics, the predictions came before the measurements. So of course, we're all philosophers, and we say, oh, it doesn't matter what time order it comes in. But we all know in our heart of hearts it matters what time order it comes in. And the fact is, CDM made the predictions for these things before they were measured, and the measurements are beautiful, and they all not only agree with CDM, but in the sort of 11 or 13 dimensional parameter space, they all intersect at a point, and including the geometry. This is really non-trivial. The model involves geometric properties and gravitational properties, and they all come together. So this is ridiculous. And of course, I'm not going to show you this evidence because it's been beaten into your head, and maybe other speakers are talking about it, maybe Amber. But anyway, yes.
Do you agree that QED is on a firmer footing than CDM?
Yes, QED is on a firmer footing for sure because it's a laboratory model. I agree with that. But the diversity and precision of these tests is pretty remarkable. Like if you look at the CMB spectrum, the large scale structure, and the cluster effects alone, forget about geometry, which is also pretty remarkable. And we're talking about 1% in a very dirty system. So anyway, I definitely think that CDM is not, you'll see my web right.
I still think, Hogg, that the statement that it's the best tested physical theory is so vague as to be meaningless.
Fine. I'll accept that objection. It's a vague statement. But my real point.
I mean, special relativity is well tested. Okay. So what's your metric for
right,
well tested?
Right, fine. So my real punchline is that all important problems in the world are ill-posed problems. There's no well-posed problem that anybody cares about.
When I started grad school, CDM meant omega matter equals 1.
Yes, well, that's true. That just means you're an old man. Okay, so the Dark Energy Task Force wrote a very nice report, really inspired by the success of CDM, The task force report, of course, advocates a lot of things, including crazy people at the Perimeter Institute doing crazy things. But if you go to the punchline level, what does everybody remember from the Dark Energy Task Force report? It says, measure W and W prime as best as you possibly can. That's all anybody remembers from the report. And I want to disagree with that as an approach for cosmology. This is just a statement of fact. Many theories that produce CDM on large scales are very different on small scales. You can imagine lots of things that on large scales look like CDM. I mean, even baryons look like CDM on very large scales. So there's a lot of possibility that despite the fact that CDM is unbelievably well tested on large scales, interesting things might happen at small scales. And by small scales here, I really mean the nonlinear regime. Because it's not really the physical length scale. It's really about whether or not there have been complex interactions or interactions that are informative or complex. So I really mean the nonlinear regime. And these implications are really robust in CDM. If you take vanilla CDM, just a single cold particle, they're really robust implications. And we have tons of observations. Right now, I'm working on in my anti-dark matter task force. It's not really anti, I shouldn't say anti, like in an appendix to the dark matter task force, which says there's some really robustly predicted things from this model. For instance, it predicts with nobody will ever deny, there's no modification of the model that gets rid of the fact that our galaxy has to live, our little galaxy has to live in this huge dark matter concentration. And that dark matter concentration has to have a size and radial profile and shape and all the substructure that is implied by this theory. So there's very strong implications for the dark matter environments of galaxies. They just can't be isolated objects. Isolated from the dark sector. And there's very strong predictions for merging, because in this model, everything grows hierarchically. You start with the smooth thing, and little things collapse, and other things collapse. And this is extremely violent and has strong time dependence. So these are ridiculously strong predictions. These are not vague statements. In fact, they're very precise.
Well, you're sweeping under the rug here. The experts can't really agree what the halo shape is, and can't really agree on the amount of substructure.
But that's partly because, but most of those issues are issues about how you quantify this. When they actually lay their simulations on top of each other, they have the same answer. Yeah, I know all about that. In fact, I spend with a third of my time, I am criticizing simulations. But the punchline level, the simulations are pretty good.
Yeah, and they will get better.
And they're getting better, et cetera, et cetera. At some point, all of this will, in fact, be predicted.
But it's also the case that some of this is an input, in the sense that this is one of the reasons people believe CDM, is because people had some estimate for what the size of galaxies were from the rotation curves and the radial profiles.
Yes.
And so not the shapes, but we still don't know anything about the shapes.
Yes,
so,
but now you're talking as if the time ordering matters.
Right. Oh, okay, now
I like that you invited us all here so that we could share. okay, good. So, but it's not trivial. These tests are amazing. These predictions are amazing, but it's not trivial to test them. Because even though this is a well-specified theory with a small number of parameters, the observational tests require photons, and the dark matter famously doesn't produce them. Well, maybe Doug thinks it does, but nobody normal thinks that it produces photons. So we have to deal with all this other crap, like stars and plasma. Even the CMB, of course, requires plasma and simple thermo. But it gets really bad. I didn't even mention black holes and accretion disks and all this stuff. So to actually measure this stuff requires all this other stuff, which is kind of what in the philosophy community would be called auxiliary models. In most things, like if you think of evolution, there's a fundamental theory which is like things evolve by natural selection. But then whenever you measure it, you have to use all this auxiliary information about like how depth relates to time and what kinds of fossils remain and so on. And we are really, really burdened by these auxiliary models because galaxies are ridiculously complicated things. And in order to test the fundamental theory, we have to have an auxiliary model that gets the galaxies right. And we certainly don't have that yet. And that's why at the end of this talk, I'm not going to give you an answer. I'm advocating that we get there. And this is really general point, by the way, in all the sciences. You never test your fundamental theory directly. Even QED, you don't test directly. Right? You still have a model for how the detectors in your experiments are related to this electron going around in the synchrotron, whatever they do. okay, so when I talk to people about this, they have one of two attitudes. One attitude, which could be the dark energy task force attitude, is that lambda CDM is incontrovertibly demonstrated. Check it out. I just said it's the most well-tested theory in the physical sciences. There can be nothing wrong with this theory. Stop throwing your galaxies at my theory. That's one attitude we encounter a lot. And people in this room aren't so inclined to that because you've got, especially at perimeter, people depend on lambda CDM being wrong. So I'm with you. But the other attitude, which is probably more the perimeter attitude, is, but these galaxies are so complicated, I can't deal with them. So even though I don't believe CDM at all, I'll never be able to use galaxies to test it, because they're such messy things. And these are the kind of two attitudes I always encounter when I talk about this. And I'm trying, this is what builds my flag. Okay, so my position, I called it our position because I can throw Peeble's name here because we're writing our dark energy task force competitor right now. So our position is CDM makes very strong predictions. These predictions must be tested. We're physicists. If you have a model that's very well tested, you have to bring it to all the other regimes and test it. Einstein's gravity works really well. That didn't stop us from continuing to test it, obviously. So this is really important. We are physicists. But importantly, tests are only tests if they have the power to falsify the model. And that's brutal, because we're facing these auxiliary problems where galaxies are really complicated. So it's very hard to come up with a test that actually falsifies the theory. But it's very funny, if you look at the literature in testing CDM, there's a lot of papers that claim to test the CDM, but if you read them, basically what they say is our observations are consistent with CDM. That's not really a test of CDM unless you show that there was a reasonable outcome of your experiment that would have crushed it. So what I'm working on is trying to find the test that's falsified the fundamental theory. That's challenging. And I've already said that a million times. Okay, good. So this is a galaxy. I'm now going to show you, this is the irrelevant data part of the talk, where I'm going to just throw data at you. But the point of the data is to show you that we have a huge amount of information about galaxies. So maybe galaxies can't be used to test CDM, but damn, we have a lot of data. So here, this is the companion to the Whirlpool. There's the Whirlpool. So this is basically SDSS resolution roughly. This is an SDSS image. And now I'm going to set back by factors of 2, so factors of 4 in solid angle, and we're just going to roll back till we see the sky.
After our extensive discussion about how there are no green stars yesterday, are you going to explain that this is a GRI color composite?
Yeah, these are funny. These are, forget about.
Wait, before we step back again, yes, you're really stupid.
Yes.
Are we talking about falsifying CDM or lambda CDM?
Good question. I would say falsifying the standard cosmological model, which is lambda CDM. It's the 13 parameter or whatever cover number parameters is thing that explains all those large scale tests.
Yeah,
so it includes lambda. Lambda definitely enters into these tests, but just very weakly.
Good question. I mean, if you say what the perimeter people are interested in doing, and a lot of us also interested in doing, is looking for something that makes more sense than lambda. But that doesn't say anything about what CDM is doing.
Well, right. I agree. So the galaxies are going to give you much more information about the dark matter particle than about the dark energy.
That would separate those two things.
Right. However, if the dark energy has any dynamical influence, it will enter these tests at some level, because it will affect things like clustering and infall, which are definitely affect galaxy evolution.
Right.
So I don't want to make that separation completely, but you're right that I'm much more talking about the dark matter particle than the dark energy.
Speaking for the parameter, I don't think anything makes more sense than lambda.
You should reserve that comment for tomorrow afternoon. okay, good. So I'm going to step back now on factors of 2 just to show you the data. And this, the data I'm going to show you actually contains information about CDM in two very distinct ways. One is there's the galaxies. And this is a very nearby galaxy, the Whirlpool. But this is more like the galaxy that I'm talking about. I'm talking about these galaxies, of which, as you see as we zoom back, there's a hell of a lot of them. But there's also stars in this image. This is a star in our own galaxy, and the stars in our own galaxy give us information about the dark matter halo in our own galaxy. So in this data set, there's both information about lots of other galaxies and a lot of detailed information about our own. So there's a lot of information here. And I just step back to show it off. So here we go, factors of 4 in solid angle. Boom, boom. And you can see now that this is actually quite unusual, this galaxy. In fact, it's the most beautiful galaxy in the sky. I've blotted out a really bright star there, which is Mizar. Does anybody here know what Mizar is? I think it's Mizar, actually, not totally sure it's Mizar. And there, do you recognize that constellation? And this is the sky as God sees it.
It's not Mizar.
Which one's Mizar?
The middle one in the handle.
That's Mizar. See, I don't know any astronomy. I don't know any astronomy.
Thank God the inflation people are here.
So, I'll use the service call
astrometry.net. So I basically talked about this. The idea is to find quantities that we can predict strongly so we can falsify. And we're trying to do models that are, we're trying to use the data in an informative way. Because when you have huge amounts of data, you don't want to be throwing it away. So we're trying to literally find things that have, that maximize our fisher information. And this, we're only just starting this, but this is why the project's really big. We have these auxiliary models, we have to marginalize over shit we don't know, and we're trying to maximize our information. We also, because these auxiliary models are about like how the galaxies form, we also want to use observations to rule out other observations or to constrain other observations, because that's how you kind of pin down these auxiliary models. Like you have to have consistency among all your different observational tests. And I have this here. Oh yeah, right. So this is an example. So this is an out-of-date simulation, so ignore the details of the simulation, but this is just something to, that is supposed to remind you that we have simulations of the dark sector. This is a dark matter-only simulation, and it ends up with a pair of galaxies that are thought to be like the Milky Way and Andromeda. And I want you to notice that there's a hell of a lot of stuff going on here. There's things smashing into each other, there's tons of substructure, there's stuff everywhere, and it's crashing in throughout cosmic time. There's your redshift indicator there. This is the Milky Way, that's Andromeda coming in. And you see both galaxies are being pummeled by tons of dark matter substructure. They also both live in these huge dark matter halos. On this scale, the Milky Way would be a very little thing there. That's sort of what I'm talking about in terms of there being a lot of information there. And in this dark matter, in this dark sector, by which I mean the dark matter, there's this growth by merging, there's all these collisions, there's all this substructure, there's simulations which might not be beautiful, but they exist. And then if you look at galaxies in the universe, what do you see? You see green grids in the sky. Sorry about the grid. But if you look at this galaxy here, this galaxy is some spheroid with a disk in it. Look how thin that disk is. Beautiful thin disk. And if you look carefully at disks like this, you find that they contain old stars, stars that have lived for long periods of time. This doesn't look like something that's being pummeled by substructure. It looks like a very quiet thin disk. Now, of course, you wouldn't necessarily see it because this object is smaller than the dark matter halo, but this looks like, this doesn't make you think, oh, crazy shit's going on in the dark sector. Here's M87. That's the jet. That little blue spot in there is the famous relativistic jet coming out of the black hole. Also, a galaxy that doesn't overwhelm you with violent activity. Although the black hole is pretty exciting, and there are some companions here that are falling in. There are some galaxies that are undergoing terrifying collisions. This is a pair of Milky Way-like spirals that are colliding, and they're throwing off such large distance. This is an amazingly dramatic collision, but it's the fact that almost everyone in this room has seen this collision before tells you that they're very rare on the sky. There aren't many to choose from that you can put up on the ViewGraph machine, because there just aren't that many that look that are this clear. Basically, things like this are like one in 10,000. Like in the whole NGC catalog, this is the best merger, and that's 8,000 things. Now, there's a few others. You might say there's 5 or 6 things that are clearly mergers like this in the NGC catalog, so maybe it's 1 in 1,000, but it's not very common that you see real violent activity. So I'm not going to focus on that, but I wanted to bring up this tension. This is how I got started on this subject, thinking about this subject, because there's been a tension in astronomy for a long time that if you're a theorist, you say, smash, smash, smash. And if you're an observer, you say, oh, beautiful island universe is floating in space. And this tension isn't really a problem, but it isn't necessarily a problem because there's all these auxiliary things. There's these baryons and star formation we don't really understand, and the galaxies are smaller than the halos, and so maybe we can escape it all, but it is a little strange that there's this tension. And that's kind of where I'm coming from, but that's just a comment about my own psychology. So I'm going to focus now on merging, and now I'm going to just show you an observational test. So I told you I'm not going to rule out CDM today. I won't rule out CDM probably in 10 years, but I hope that I can move the community along the path of trying to actually do hard tests of the model using our data. Halos are merging. I showed you that in the video. Of course, you can do this quantitatively. And they're merging even at the present day. That activity that's going on in the local group hasn't stopped at redshift zero. And that's true even in accelerating models. It's one of the places where the dark energy comes in. Is it does affect this activity, although only weakly. When these dark matter things merge, the galaxies that are in those dark matter things must eventually find each other and merge. So there has to be merging in this model, and this merging is observationally practical.
Can I ask a naive question?
Yes, please do.
Do we see that in this picture that you have in the simulation, you would be led to think that, okay, maybe things are quiet today, but in the past they were not. So do you see, as a function of redshift, there are more and more...
Right, so good. So another prediction of these models is that the activity should be greater in the past.
Right.
And yes, that is roughly confirmed in the sense that most measures of activity, like numbers of close pairs, amount you see morphological disturbances like tidal tails and star formation rates, look greater in the past, like there's more activity in the past. So that is at the order of magnitude level confirmed, but not in any way precise. There's no precise test. And actually, one of the things I'll talk about is what redshift should you work at, which is a hard question because this evolution contains a huge amount of information, because there's a long time baseline, which means you've got this big lever arm on the model, but the data become less good as you go out. So there's a trade-off in what redshift, how you want to look at this. That's a very good point to keep in mind. I'm not going to talk about it except to blow it off in a few grid graphs. I'm not going to talk about that. That's very observational, but it relates to the fact that we need all of our observations to be consistent. I'm going to measure galaxies merging. When galaxies merge, they must grow. People measure the growth of galaxies. I'm measuring the merging. These things have to agree. And it's not even clear that the observations agree right now, let alone the observations in theory. That's one of the reasons I'm not going to claim to rule anything out right now. So we are using our observations to make predictions about other observations, and this helps us pin down these auxiliary models. And the way I think about this is there's a continuity equation. There are galaxies have sources and sinks in some parameter space, and we're trying to see them come in from the sources and go out through the sinks. And the sinks are basically merging events. Galaxies are destroyed in merging events. And we're going to use closed pairs. So I'm going to do the dumbest possible thing. We're going to look at closed pairs and see if we can infer things about galaxy merging, which we can. Why am I working, this is in answer to your question, why am I working at redshift of a third? The reason I'm working at redshift of a third is very, very pragmatic. It's just because we have hellacious amounts of data. I'll tell you later about the properties of the data, but the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which I just showed you, is a ridiculous data set at this redshift. And there's nothing that comes even close. So even though we don't get the time baseline, we have such large numbers and such high signal to noise on the objects. The typical objects that I'm talking about have beautiful spectroscopy, beautiful images, and we can measure their properties really accurately. But the disadvantage is we're not at the peak of this activity. The peak of the activity was more like redshift of 1. Redshift of 2, maybe.
The peak of the activity for galaxy evolution.
For galaxy evolution.
CDM halo stuff should still be just...
It continues on, but it's still...
Your observations are getting increasingly poorly matched to what we think the dark...
That's kind of true, yeah. Though, in some things get better matched with time, and some things get worse. I'm just talking about ass when I say it.
So what is poorly matched?
Well, I mean, he's talking about, so the dark sector is what was the word, active? And the light sector is quiet, but you're talking about different scales. Like, the light sector on galaxy scale is very quiet. In the dark sector, when you're
on group scales, it's very active.
Today, it's very active. And right. On galaxy scale, the redshift 3 was very accurate.
You're talking about star formation, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about the characteristic mass of mergers is growing the time, whereas galaxies are not to zero order.
Yeah, and I shouldn't have a diagram like this in my talk. For the Milky Way is about 10 kiloparsecs in size, the disk, maybe 20 in radius, but the dark matter is like 200. So it's not a huge separation in scales, but it's big enough that maybe this will escape things. But if you go back in time, the relative sizes aren't quite as bad if you get very far back in time. Because everything's growing. Like the dark matter halos are growing, but the galaxies are clearly growing more slowly.
Okay, but half the mass is inside of 30 kiloparsecs or so. So even though the variable radius is 200 or 300, it's not true that most of the mass is out.
No, that's right. There's a lot, right. So it's not, anyway, the whole story is quite complicated, actually, and it's not well. And that one of the problems is that hasn't all been kind of worked out in the way I would like to really, because fundamentally the people who work on the dark sector don't think about it being precisely tested. They just don't imagine that that will happen, and that's a problem. That's what I think is the problem. I'm just going to talk about one very specific class of galaxies, which are these luminous red galaxies. Why? Because these are very simple galaxies. They're extremely massive. Well, simple, if you work on galaxy evolution, you would laugh when I said that. But they're simple from an observational point of view, and if we can't understand them, we can't understand anything. They are about redshift of a third, and I have 100,000 spectra, plus people in this room are working on getting 600,000 more. So this is going to become a ridiculous sample. They are like three times as massive as Milky Way or larger, so they're very massive galaxies. And they're known to reside in very massive dark matter concentrations. So a typical one of these galaxies will also be about 10 kiloparsecs in size, but much more massive. And the halo it's in is more like a megaparsec in size. Very big halos. They're very big galaxies and very big halos. And their stellar populations are simple. And from a theoretical point of view, because of resolution and things like that, we understand the most massive galaxies best. So we might not understand them, but we definitely understand them better than anything else. So I'm trying to work on the most well-understood things with the largest sample, and that's so this is an example, M87, which I showed earlier. M87 is a classic luminous red galaxy, and it has a huge black hole in the center. It's got a relativistic jet coming out of it. It's got a very uniform seat. It's a very smooth profile. There's no disk there. It's just a spheroid of stars. They're all really old. They're all really similar. It's a very, very simple kind of galaxy, very easy to measure. It's also extremely high surface brightness at the center, so it's very easy to detect, very easy to take a spectrum, very easy to get a redshift. They're just the best galaxies in the world for this kind of work in the universe.
Is the statement that they're really massive just part of how you've chosen to define luminous red galaxies?
Yes.
Or are there just no...
No, there's a full spectrum of masses, but we're cutting off at only the massive ones. No, there's a full spectrum. Like there's these. These are the same, or this galaxy here is the same as this one. You can see in terms of its color and its shape and so on, but really, really tiny. So we're not doing these. Actually, there's another galaxy PE in there.
So that's just by being luminous you cut them, or is that any other measure of mass?
We're just doing luminous, but it turns out these galaxies are so simple that the luminosity and the mass are very tightly related. So there's basically no...
So luminous and mass.
Exactly. Luminous and mass are the same for these. Again, another reason to work on these galaxies is luminosity is mass, which is good. What I'm doing is really, really dumb. If two galaxies merge, then at some point in the past, they were spatially close. So I'm looking for spatially close things, and we count pairs that are about to merge. And what we do, the way we really do this is, would bore anybody working on anti-consider space, but it involves measuring a projected correlation function, then assuming isotropy and deprojecting, and then doing statistics on that. And in fact, we don't even do that. We do something better with respect to the data than that. But anyway, it's something like that. And we use a very important physical constraint, which is that if you have two galaxies, those galaxies have there's a dynamical time you can associate with those galaxies, which is kind of the time it takes them to orbit one another. Because we know their masses, and we know their separations, and we know how long it takes them to orbit. And there's basically no way to get two galaxies to merge in a time shorter than the time it takes them to do one orbit. Now, you can have a galaxy plunge through radially. That saves you 2 pi. But in fact, when you do that, you bash through and then come back. And if you look at the whole thing, it actually appears as two galaxies for this same period of time. And besides which, collisions like that are unbelievably rare. So this dynamical time limit is a really strict limit on how quickly a pair of galaxies can merge. And that strictness is very important for me because I'm facing a lot of uncertainties. But I have one strict thing that I know. And by the way, our galaxies don't look like M87. They look like that. This is a sample, truly a randomly selected sample of luminous red galaxies that are in close pairs. Notice each of these is a close pair. Being in a close pair is fairly unlikely for one of these galaxies. In pairs this close, it's like 1 in 1,000 that are in pairs as close. You can see they're all pairs, and then some are even quads, triples. There's kind of a clustering of clustering, so once you're in pairs, it's high order statistics. So being in pairs tends to find you in other things. And one of the things, another thing to keep in mind is that not all of these pairs are going to merge. That's another thing that's also going to help my argument at the end. Not all of these pairs are going to merge. Like, look at this. This is probably a group of galaxies that are all orbiting in some complicated way. They're not all just going to go, boom, one galaxy. They are doing something complicated. They're not going to all merge in a dynamical time. So I'm being very, very conservative in my sense, which we'll see what it is, by saying that the dynamical time is the fastest they can merge. That's extremely conservative. Here is the correlation function. So I'm assuming that most people in this room know what the definition of a correlation function is. This, and I have said for many years that this correlation function is measured on a larger dynamic range than any other correlation function in the physical sciences. And it turns out I'm wrong. Because there are correlation functions in the atmosphere that are measured over longer scales than this. But only the atmosphere beats this. No glasses or liquids or anything do they have this range of scales. So look at the range of scales. This goes from 100 megaparsecs. This is the baryon acoustic feature that we're all on about. And then if you go down to 10 megaparsecs, 10 megaparsecs is kind of like the nonlinear scale. This is where things are just starting to, orbits are just starting to turn around. And 1 megaparsec is kind of the scale at which it's the size of the dark matter halos of these objects. So this is kind of the scale where things are virialized. So this is like linear regime, just going nonlinear, virialized objects. And then once you get down to 100 kiloparsecs, the galaxies start to disrupt each other, and tidal friction takes over, and they start to merge. So there's a merging regime, a virialized regime, a weakly nonlinear regime, and a linear regime. And I don't see any feature in this power law. Look at it. We think that different physics is controlling the pairs here, than here, than here, than here. And it all lies on that line. That is pretty insane. I'm not going to talk about that because I have no understanding of that at all. If you plot the same thing for the dark matter, so take a dark matter simulation and plot the dark matter correlation, it does not look like this. Unfortunately, nobody publishes it because nobody thinks it's an observable. But what it looks like, basically, this blue line is somehow related to it in a way I don't want to describe. But basically, it comes above this blue line and then it comes down. It has a feature here where it rejoins and then comes onto this. On large scales, the dark matter looks like galaxies, and then on small scales, they depart dramatically. And the dark matter does show differences in the tidal disruption regime, the virialized regime, and the weakly nonlinear regime. There are features in the dark matter, but somehow galaxies remove all those features.
Well, you know that people have seen those kind of features.
Yes, we have the strongest detection of it. Actually, we're not yet through refereeing, but we actually have the strongest detection of this transition from this cosmological regime to this virialized regime in the detection. Because there is, in fact, a small feature here that you can find by cutting the data the right way. So Pat's right. I'm kind of bullshitting here. But it is remarkable that it looks like a goddamn power law. Like, I just wrote this thing down. We didn't, like, fit this. It just looks like a power law on this amazing range of scales. Look at this. 10 to my student, 10 to the 6. Yes?
Sorry. How is the dark matter correlation function measured with those small scales?
It isn't. Okay. The dark matter correlation function has never been measured. All we've ever measured is, there's two things we've measured. There's galaxy-galaxy correlation functions, like this, and there's galaxy-mass correlation functions, which have been measured through weak lensing, through gravitational lensing. So it's not, the dark matter correlation function is not an observable yet. If Finkbeiner is right, it's an observable.
So you're talking about simulations.
I'm talking about simulations, exactly. Now, but it is true that there's this, you've probably heard this NFW before. This NFW, this is a bad thing, because this is something that was created through like very careful vetting and looking at simulations. But there's a very simple statistic you can do in simulations, which is just the two-point cross-correlation function of dark matter with itself. And that is a much better thing to be talking about than this NFW thing, which is some strange hand-drawn thing. Because the two-point correlation function of dark matter is just straight up predicted by the simulations.
And NF and W, none of the three of them actually believe it's still a good fit.
Well, I think N does, more or less. But I don't know.
Well,
no. We can ask W.
No, because N's written a paper that supersedes it.
Okay.
So can I have a super naive question?
Yes, please ask.
I have perimeter question.
Yeah, good.
So if is the statement that if I were to add baryons to your simulations, then it would tend to remove these bumps that you would expect? Or?
Good question. That's an excellent question. The answer to that is not no. So right now, there are some simulations that try to put baryons on, try to form galaxies realistically, and try to produce galaxies in a cosmological context ab initio, like just goddamn put in all the physics and just run it. And it does reduce, those models do reduce the amplitude of these features here. So the fact that the features don't exist here may end up getting explained theoretically. But right now, it's not completely explained. But it is certainly true that the theory kind of moves you in the right direction. And I don't have a specific plot of that, but Simon White actually has the plot that attempts to match this piece of data exactly. And they don't match it exactly. They still see some departures, but it is closer than the dark matter correlation. And I would like to give you a simple explanation. It's because this interacts with that and it falls in like this, but I don't have any hand-waving explanation of it. It's just they're reduced. There's another approach to dealing with this, and the way most people in my business deal with this problem is they believe that the CDM correlation function is correct, and then they just place galaxies carefully into the mass field so that they get this correlation function out. And like these authors, they spend their time putting galaxies into the dark matter field to get this to match, so that CDM is correct and this is correct, and they force it to be correct. So this doesn't become a test of CDM at all. It's a force to make the auxiliary model work.
We're both co-authors on that paper you're writing on.
Yes. Yeah. I'm on all three of these papers. in fact, I'm second author on these. So people have moved away from using this to test CDM. They've moved to using this to test the auxiliary models and produce the auxiliary models, which I'm now going to use to test CDM. So the context is, people put the galaxies into the dark matter distribution to get this right. Now, what does it imply for merging? And I can now test that. So that's why I'm saying that part of this process, why what I'm doing is so goddamn complicated, is because I can't just test CDM. What I have to do is run many tests and get a consistent picture about all the auxiliary models and then ask whether it's consistent with CDM. That's kind of what's going on. So this is now used to just force fit galaxy evolution to CDM.
But let me ask you something. So yes. The small scale, the master data of that, can these semiotic models actually do that? Because that dark matter...
No. The semi-analytic models don't fit this, but the funny thing is the ab initio simulations don't do such a bad job. And the reason is, now this is going to get a little crazy. So the reason is, this is a power law, R to the minus 2. Where do you get R to the minus 2 density? Right. If you have a star that's blowing off a wind, you know, if you have a star blowing off a continuous wind, it gets r to the minus 2 density profile around it because it's just blowing off mass at a constant rate and it's expanding by r to the 2. Remember that from undergrad? Now, this is like an inverse stellar wind. What's happening? The galaxies at small separation are flowing in because they're merging. And so around every LRG, there's an inverse stellar wind of LRGs flowing in. And that creates this art of minus two. And that happens in the simulation. That happens in the ab initio simulations, too, because they dynamically account for all the motions of the galaxies. So that's one of the reasons this dark matter thing gets corrected like this in the simulations, is that there's this kind of inverse stellar wind going on at small scales.
But that doesn't make any sense, because I mean, that means you don't have an angular momentum. So but you just said it never happens, and they don't really...
Yeah. Right. I'm waving my hands. But I'm happy to talk about that afterwards, because that's a pretty interesting question.
This is another naive question.
Yes, please.
Can you show on that plot what the dynamic range of any individual simulation is?
Ooh, good question. That's an excellent question. Basically, no simulations reliably work at 20 kiloparsecs. Essentially none. There's a few that work on the group scale that just try and do a group of galaxies that get down here. So there's simulations that kind of do this piece, and there's simulations that do this piece, and there's simulations that do this piece. It's roughly two orders of magnitude that you can really believe in a simulation. Am I being too mean?
But there are simulations that tie them together.
You can overlap.
You overlap them. In fact, what they do is they do this simulation, cut out a box, refine, and do this simulation, cut out a box, refine, and do this simulation. So they're not just overlapped statistically, they're overlapped like in full phase space.
So you can do, in effect, a consistent simulation over,
right,
say, three or four.
But you don't get the whole volume over that whole range. So,
same techniques and physics.
Right. Well, it's not quite the same physics because the people change the smoothing length. There's discreteness and smoothing effects which are different in the refined
simulations. Yeah, but I mean, it's not a difference.
It's not physics, right. It's just what physicists do.
It's not physics, but it's also not numerical techniques that are different.
No, right. It is literally, but the simulations, I mean, we actually organized this thing at NYU, which is very fun, because NYU is an applied math center. So the Courant Institute. So we brought together the Courant numerical people and the people who do cosmology simulations, and there was absolutely no point of contact. Because basically the mathematicians were like, what is the large N limit equations that you're solving? And the simulators are like, it doesn't really work that way. Anyway, so I've said all this already. The highest possible merger rate is to assume that the close pairs, the ones that are close enough that dynamical friction is going to kick in, are merging at a dynamical time. And when we do this operation, and there's a lot of details about this, which I'm obviously skipping. There's a lot of thought goes into this. And it turns out it doesn't matter exactly what scale we choose because of this art of minus two stellar wind argument. It doesn't actually matter what radius we pick at because we have this art of minus two. Anyway, it's a long story. But what we find is that LRGs have something like a 1% probability per billion years of having a merger with another LRG. So these LRG-LRG mergers are very rare. And this is a strict upper limit. It's a very, and I remind you that the universe is 14 billion years old. So we're not talking about huge amounts of growth for these galaxies.
Oh, wait, and your typical one has emerged for 100 billion years then?
That's right.
Which means never. So how are you defining a merger again? It's merging with something that's at least a third of the mass.
No, which is also an LRG. That's
which
what
is also an LRG.
Yeah,
sorry.
So these are, we're talking, it's okay. Not surprising that this number is low. You expect a low number here because we're talking about very massive galaxies, which are rare, colliding with other very massive galaxies. And you get a boost because they're both massive, so they bind each other, but you're basically, their rareness dominates, and so you expect a small number.
How big is that mass one? Can you just give me some sense of what mass is?
We go from something like three times Milky Way to infinity, but the mass function is cutting off very sharply. So really, the mass spin is only about a factor of three in width. It's not a huge mass spin. So we're talking about a narrow mass spin, a very massive.
Dominated at the low part.
Yes, it's dominated right at the edge. Yeah, which we spend a lot of time thinking about. That's something we're.
This is basically equal mergers.
These are basically equal mergers, a very massive object. So you expect a low rate. I haven't said anything that's even.
So those two big guys in coma, for example, just to,
yes,
they would meet this criteria.
They would meet the criteria, but they're clearly not going to merge anytime soon.
Depending on which angle you're looking at them, you might think that they would.
here we have statistically deprojected. So we believe, modulo systematics, we believe that we are actually talking about the three-dimensional abundance of pairs in three-dimensional configuration space, not x, y, redshift, but really x, y, z. W, x, y. space. So we're deprojecting. So we're not subject to the usual Carl Berg and Patton issues. Here they are. There's a famous industry in Canada of doing this, and there's some very nice papers that sort of began this field. This is not new to us. In fact, it started here in Canada, the idea of using the close pairs and continuity to understand convergence. We want to compare to theory. That's the point of this. I spent this whole polemic on it, and I'm going to now punt. No papers predict exactly what we observe. And the reason is that there's infinite numbers of choices of what you might predict. I don't think people are seriously expecting the models to be tested. Because what would you do if you were writing a theoretical paper? Wouldn't you look at what the best data set is out there and try and predict for that data set? No. So there's no theoretical prediction that exactly matches the best data set that's available. We are working on this problem. We hope to have it soon. However, we are pretty sure we know what the answer is going to be, because if we take the existing papers and extrapolate to a regime, we expect something like 5 to 10% . So I'm pretty sure with the current auxiliary models, we are going to have a substantial conflict with CDM. However, I cannot tell you right now that we have a conflict. And of course, most people in the business are going to say, well, that means the auxiliary models are wrong. And I'm like, fine, okay. But then we start working on the auxiliary models to still match that correlation function, get this right, get weak lensing right, and so on. So the plan is to spawn that process, and then many decades from now, I will tell you, there's a fifth force in the dark sector that kicks in at 200 kiloparsecs. No, I won't tell you that. But hopefully, the hope is that as we go, eventually, we will find out some things that are informative discrepancies to CDM. But I can't give you an informative discrepancy right now. And this is what I just said. Where the galaxies reside in the dark matter field, there's this halo occupation approach, which I talked about. There's this ab initio approach, where you really just try and simulate it all. But anything you do here makes predictions, not just for the correlation function, and not just for the merging I showed, but also for high-order statistics, for gravitational lensing, which I mentioned measures the galaxy mass correlation function, and for how things evolve with redshift, as you. Okay, this is where I'm sure any discrepancy we have, I'm not claiming any problems with CDM. I'm sure that the discrepancies we have are going to come in the auxiliary models. However, there's a hell of a lot of work to be done to make that work.
I don't want to make a big fuss about it, but we've looked at a version of this for clusters, just in simulations.
Yes.
Just asking, are closed pairs good quantities for rendering?
Yes.
You have all the information.
Right, exactly. You have all the information.
And then suck.
Exactly.
It's not very good. So,
but that strengthens my argument, right? That says the fact that they suck. You see, I'm like Crayola. Any problem with my product spawns a new product. That just means that I need to have a less than sign here, right? So that makes it even better, right? That makes my conflict better.
Well, we were specifically trying to address whether you could use observations as a way to get at this and tie it to, and it's just, it's extremely hard, is what we found. Just based on simulations.
Good.
Not even, you know.
I agree.
Are we having
good, so the question is, the question I want to ask is, do you nonetheless get a limit, though? Can you put a robust limit?
Yeah.
I bet you can.
So that's the thing. I mean, you can generate good statistics, and you can, But
you say they suck. There are many ways of sucking.
Yeah.
It's just basically what you say is in your simulation, you can identify all halos that have had a recent merger, defined by, say, you know, least ratio of a third. And then, I've got all these, and I'll do something like I'm going to do a correlation function of those, and I'm going to compare it to all close pairs and do a correlation function of those.
Right.
And they're very different.
So are there a lot
but
of close
one,
pair?
I bet it's
really
one side.
Murder was what's close pair, but not what the close pair was what's
close pairs
pair.
Don't, you know,
right.
A lot of happenstance, galaxies coming near.
My PR team is all over that, and we're releasing the press release, and we're adding this extra little less than sign there.
I mean, but it's...
because it's really fundamental that this is an upper limit.
Is there one little cat? This is in the cluster scale. This is not
right, absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
Just to get the statistics right.
Okay. No, that's a great
Okay, but so these are guys, so it's really different.
They are different. They're absolutely different.
The point is, your basic intuition, which says, you know, this the whole basic story of close pairs are good proxies for mergers.
Right, but I don't need it to be good proxies. I just need them to be one-sided.
Right.
I'm just trying because I'm in a situation. I am facing horrible auxiliary marginalization, so I need something I can fix on. This is one of the things we're doing. This is something we're doing right now. Is trying to. When I said we're working on it somewhere here, what I mean is we're going to ab initio simulations and asking, are the close pairs merging in anything like a dynamical card, and see if we can improve this. Or find out that this just doesn't work. And that's definitely a possibility.
Yeah, how do you get your dynamical time? I mean, you find a pair, you try to...
It's relatively dumb. We have a spectrum of every one of these galaxies. Well, not of every one of these galaxies, but in every pair we have a spectrum of at least one of the two galaxies. And they, in that spectrum, we get a velocity dispersion, which tells us something about the mass density at small scales. And we know about how the mass runs with radius from gravitational lensing. So we can say in a statistical sense for each galaxy what its dynamical time ought to be for test particle going around.
Do you know? I mean, are there environmental effects? I mean, when you see these simulations like you showed from Kratzoff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, the galaxies are kind of like sliding down these filaments and things.
Yeah, right.
Could that produce the dynamical time?
Yeah, it could definitely improve the dynamical times by thinking about the larger environment, and we're not doing that. So this is right, but that will tend to lengthen the times.
Wait, hang on, I'm confused. You're measuring the dynamical time within an individual galaxy?
Yes, the galaxies are overlapping.
That's the time you're interested in, right? I mean, it's a different dynamical time for something to go around in an individual galaxy. It's not the same for the two. You're saying
that's true. So we make a correction for that. Right, so we try, we know, what we don't know, we don't really know what the dynamical state of this object is. We do, however, know that for this object isolated, what its dynamical state is, and we know for this object isolated. And we're trying, we infer a dynamical time based on that. However, we could be very wrong.
But couldn't it be dramatically wrong?
We could be dramatically wrong, but it tends to be wrong. It's very hard to make it wrong in a way that speeds it up. Because you can just see the central densities of these objects. You can see the velocities versus the central densities. You can just see the stellar density. They're star dominated at the centers. So you can just measure the density of stars here, and you can estimate the time scale. And you're not wrong by an order of magnitude.
That makes sense within an individual galaxy.
Yes.
But the thing that I'm hanging
the question
up on
is, can this situation be an order of magnitude faster? Mm-hmm. And answer, no. I'm not answering.
So is that diagram the scale? So that this you drew it on top of this other diagram. It's actually pretty close, right?
Yeah, it is. It is pretty close. Right, and except the halo would be 5 times bigger.
But you're comparing it with some of those were halo model predictions, right?
Yes.
And what does the halo model do with two lumps like that that are embedded in a group? Like that's substructure in substructure.
That's right.
And do they track that far down?
No, and in fact, the halo models are known to be wrong at really small scales. Like, they have to be wrong. In fact, one of the other papers we're writing is about how they have to be wrong at small scales. So
I don't understand how they have that object even in the halo tail.
They don't really. So the halo model, all the halo model does is get us a statistical relationship between the halos and the galaxies. It's only the ab initio. I said when we want to improve this, we have to use the ab initio models. That's because we actually need to know what orbits the galaxies are on to improve our estimates.
Right. So in the halo model, the number of those things should be 0.0.
No, because they're put into the dark matter halos. Some halos get two galaxies, and sometimes those galaxies happen to be close.
But they won't be within, they won't have overlapping griddle. They won't have overlapping.
These are two galaxies in the same halo, in the halo occupation.
And one is the BCG.
Right, one is the BCG, and one is a companion that happens to be very close.
Well, most of these things are also going to be in groups, right? So they're in a group, and it's a galaxy in a group. And do they go another generation down?
No, they don't. They don't. That's why the Halo model, but we're not relying on the Halo model for our analysis. We're certainly not relying on it. Some of the theories partially rely on it, but they try and deal with this problem in some sensible way by looking at sub-Halo mergers.
Can I just ask
One
more related question? So if you have your galaxy, say the two mergers that you're talking about are the central galaxies of the cluster.
Yes.
So you're talking about the dynamical timescale that you're measuring is the dynamical timescale of stars in the galaxy. How different, and then the dynamical timescale that you really care about is the relies on the velocity dispersion of the galaxies in the cluster, not the stars in the galaxy.
Well, on very small scales, if you look at a BCG and you go into very small scales of the brightest galaxy in a cluster, you actually find that the velocity dispersion drops inside.
That was my question. Is it true that the velocity dispersion of the galaxies in the cluster near the center
are lower? Yeah, it's lower than the galaxy cluster.
But then comparable to the velocity dispersion of the stars in the galaxy?
Well, I don't know how well that's really known, but that's what people believe. But it's not based on full like potential density pairs. So I don't know how reliable it is. But that's certainly what's said in the like 2D spectroscopy literature. But I'm not an expert, and I don't entirely trust them. We've done this. The big problem with this is that it's very high mass mergers. We've also done all of the minor mergers as well. And even when we add up all the minor mergers, we still find that they're only growing by 3% per billion years with the maximal assumptions we're making. And that's also very low. And this is just, it's on an archive, actually, but it's just, and I'm out of time now, but I just wanted to show you some more pretty pictures. So I said there's very few merging galaxies that are really obvious on the sky. There are some that are obvious on the sky. There was the antennae, which I think are coming up in a second. I forget what, I think these are called the eyes, you know?
No, that's also important.
We should ask the there are post-merger things on the sky. This is some kind of post-merger thing where galaxies with different angular momentum vectors have merged and they're now relaxing. So there's a lot of systems in which you might be able to infer things about merger rates or mergers by looking at individual galaxies, and this is another kind of approach to the problem, which is kind of older than the approach that Carlberg and Patton started with pairs. And there's very post-merger things, and it's actually thought that if you count the shells here, you can actually figure out how long ago this merger happened. So even some of them even have clocks on them. And this is a long story, but one of the things to keep in mind is that in principle, these systems are so dynamically rich. In principle, even an individual system like this might tell you something about the dark matter, because it's so dynamically rich, you've got curving tidal arms. You might not be able to explain the data if you don't screw with the dark matter. So this is kind of an interesting idea that people worked on in the 80s, but has been abandoned because everyone believes CDM. They've abandoned this idea, but back in the 80s when people didn't know, they were doing experiments like this. And in fact, there are some papers which are now known to be wrong, which claim to measure the density of the universe using this. And that's the summary that I start with next. Yeah, so I should talk about lensing because the other place where I think, because I said that there's two basic things, halos and merging, and then I went and talked about merging. But halos are also really exciting because now there's quite a bit of weak lensing stuff, and there's now a galaxy dark matter cross-correlation function measured for a wide variety of different kinds of galaxies, and there are detailed maps of a whole bunch of clusters. So there's a hell of a lot of information there that potentially has CDM. Right now, and I think it might be a truly fundamental limitation, right now you can only see substructure in the very most massive objects. So you can only look at the lens, only the largest lumps of substructure in the most massive galaxy, most massive galaxy clusters shows up in weak lensing maps. And because of the scalings of weak lensing as you go deeper into fainter objects, it's not clear that you'll ever measure the substructure around like a luminous red galaxy, let alone a Milky Way. I think we're more likely to see substructure in, there's two opportunities for substructure that I'm excited about. One is strong lensing, where you ask, can you explain the details of the strong lens, and given that the individual images are perturbed by the substructure? And another, and there's work going on in that now, and another is looking at the kinematic state of our galaxy's halo. Because there's tons of stars streaming through our halo, we believe they came in cold accretion events, and if that's all true, then we ought to be able to see perturbations from substructure. So I think we're more likely to see substructure. That said, the very best way to see substructure is to have the dark matter particle annihilate. So as long as Doug can set that up for us.
That wasn't my idea.
No, apparently that comes from the WIMPs generically.
Been around about 30 years.
But anyway, if the dark matter annihilates, the substructure lights up on the sky because they're high density. The objects are their very small mass, but they're high in density. And that's what's their density squared or whatever it is for annihilation.
To put a caveat on what you said is true if you're talking about sort of, in some sense, blind searches for dark matter substructure. But if you know where to stack,
yes,
then you can extract the substructure.
Good, excellent. Yeah, that's a great point. If you could find, if you
like
could
galaxies
find
within clusters,
tracers for the substructure, then you could, do statistical tests to see if those tracers always come with a certain message. Yeah, that's a good question.
Some people have done that, for example, in clusters where there's claims that the galaxies in the innermost regions of the cluster are parts stripped.
So I have a very, very question. Does lensing affect your calculation, your correlation function? I think I was asking this before. So, I mean, you're not, the fact that basically these galaxies have potential, so they have dark matter, so there's a lensing effect that can enhance.
Yes, that's a great question. I have to think about it. In general, the lensing, the correlation function, where lensing matters, the correlation function is like 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 6 in amplitude. And most lensing effects are very small on that scale, I believe, but I've never actually calculated it. That's
okay.
A very good
question. We're going to have a coffee break and after we'll do stuff.
Right.
Can we hold the further discussion?
Yeah,
thank
you.
One more.
Stand.